I did not prepare a lecture, but the problem is if I start with some off-the-cuff remarks, it will turn into a two-hour lecture. But I am going to start with some off-the-cuff remarks, and I hope that you have questions about the readings. Those are hard, dense readings, and in an hour and 45 minutes, I want to develop two quite different ideas. One is the idea of core knowledge, which is an empirical claim that I'm going to explain and relate to Fodor's view of modularity, which I think that you've already touched on. And then the second half of the course, I'm going to talk about conceptual change. And here, Fodor thinks that everything I say is completely nuts, whereas he agrees with what I say about core knowledge. And so the point here is how one reconciles the obvious fact that human beings are unique among animals in the creation of really new knowledge that goes beyond what we start with. What are the mechanisms of that? What's the descriptive nature of how knowledge changes through development? How do you reconcile that obvious fact, and how do you think about the human capacity for conceptual change? How do you reconcile that with the fact that it's also the case that human beings have rich innate knowledge? So that's what I want you to get out of today is an understanding of both halves of the claim, what it means to say we have rich innate knowledge, and what kind of evidence we bring to bear to support that claim. And then what does it mean to say we go beyond that knowledge? Okay, so those are the two halves. And the case study all has to do with children's understanding of people or intentional agents. And the innate knowledge, I believe, is indeed the understanding of people as intentional agents. And the constructive knowledge is the understanding of people as biological beings, which is not, I think, innate in any way whatsoever. Okay, so what are we talking about today? We're talking about the development of conceptual content, the development of concepts. There are lots of other things that we can study when we're studying development. We can study the development of strategies, of skills, of reasoning, abilities, of language. But what I'm concerned with in all my work is not those things directly, but rather the development of human concepts. So one thing you have to think about, this is something that I assume all educators are interested in. We want to know how children come to grasp the concept of democracy, the concept of history, the concept of density, the concept of mass. I mean, you know, the concept of a rational number, right? And we are interested as educators in the concepts children have, the concepts they use to understand the world, because what we want them to do is to enrich that conceptual base. So what is a concept? A concept is a mental representation, and it's a symbol in the head. And as a symbol, concepts have content, meaning they refer to something in the outside world, right? So when I say I have a concept of an object, I mean that I have a mental representation in my head that refers to objects in the world. And why do I have those? Why do I have a concept of an object, or a concept of a person, or a concept of Ned Block, my husband, or a concept of my dog? Well, because what that conceptual representation does is allow me to think about dogs, my husband, etc., and also participate in predictions about them. I mean, and communicate with you about them. Right? I mean, the concepts are absolutely central to a theory of human knowledge. The concept, a concept, is a unit of thought. It articulates beliefs. So the concepts that we're interested in today are concepts roughly the grain of lexical items, like the concept like alive, or like person, or like agent. Those are concepts. So, the question is, what's the origin of human concepts, and how do concepts change within development? I cannot think of a question that's more central to the educational enterprise. But that's, of course, a self-serving view. Okay. So the first thing you read, which was a chapter from an upcoming book that's still quite drafty, as you can see, is about infants' concepts of intentional agents. And just to place this chapter in the context of the book that it's in, and also the context of the readings or classes you've been having, this book is an extended argument for an empirical proposal. The empirical proposal is there is such a thing as core knowledge. And of course, for you to know what that empirical proposal is, I have to tell you what core knowledge is. What core knowledge is modular knowledge in Fodor's sense. Okay? So, here's what core knowledge is. It's that there are innate mental representations with particular conceptual content. That is, there are some innate concepts. These innate concepts are identified, that is, the question is, how does the child recognize that something in the world falls under the concept? They're identified with the support of innate, domain-specific perceptual analyzers. Okay, so the idea is, babies, the idea in this is that babies not only have the concept of a goal innately, they also have an innate perceptual analyzer that analyzes patterns of contingent motion and things like that to identify examples of goal-directed activity. Okay, so there are innate, dedicated perceptual input analyzers that yield the representations that are in the domains of core knowledge. These representations then support learning. These continue to operate throughout the lifespan. Okay, these core knowledge doesn't change through development, except for insofar as the domain-specific learning devices itself, I mean, the knowledge is there to learn about a particular class of things. So you might have the concept of goal innately, but you might not know what the particular goals of a particular person are. Okay? So that's the empirical claim. There are systems of knowledge with those properties. Innate conceptual content continue supported by innate perceptual analyzers and continue to operate throughout the lifespan. And this chapter is a study arguing, giving you the evidence that the domain of intentionality is such a domain of core knowledge. But before we go through that, let me just give you an example from the animal learning literature that will convince you, I hope, that there's nothing suspect about these ideas. Like many people, well, Jerry Fodor always says, scratch a psychologist and you get an empiricist. That basically we tend to think that it's preferable to attribute to babies only perceptual knowledge, only sensory motor knowledge, right? There is nothing preferable one way or another. It's an empirical question, right? We're going to end up with a concept of goals and agents. Either we're going to have to learn them, and it's a real problem how we would learn them if all we have is sensory motor primitives as the input to the system. But that might be the right story. Alternatively, this is such an important part of human psychology, evolution could have given it to us. So it's an empirical question. So let me give you an example from the animal ethology literature of a perfect example of core knowledge, so that you can see that, again, it's an empirical question which domains of core knowledge there are, but there's nothing wrong with the notion of core knowledge. So the example I'd like to give is the example of indigo bunting navigation. So indigo buntings are a beautiful blue songbird, and like many birds, they fly south in the winter and north in the summer, and they fly at night. So the one question you can ask if you're a ethologist is, how do they know how to go south, and how do they know where south is at night? The obvious answer is they're using celestial navigation. But think about that. How could we prove that they are actually using celestial navigation? Well, that's actually quite easy to do, and this is work by this wonderful person, Steve Emlin. So the first thing he did was take indigo buntings and bring them into planetaria, where you can make the night sky be any arbitrary direction with respect to anything to do with the Earth. You knew that they had no other cue to go on other than the night sky. So he just arbitrarily made the night sky be any direction whatsoever. It's time for them to fly south. They took off south with respect to the night sky. So they know where the North Pole is, basically, and they can use the sky to go south. Okay, the question is, how do they represent the night sky to identify north? Okay, so there's got to be a mental representation of the night sky that picks out north. How did they learn where north was? Or was that itself innate? Did evolution build into the indigo buntings a capacity to represent north, the night sky with, you know, the North Star marked its north? Very unlikely, because the sky has changed over evolutionary time much too fast. 30,000 years ago, none of the constellations that we can see now were there, and the North Star, Polaris, wasn't north. Right, so the indigo buntings have to learn where north is. All right, how on earth could they do that? Well, maybe they follow somebody who already knows. Right, so the first time they fly south, they follow somebody and they analyze the sky to figure out what the north part of it looks like. That's not right, because the first time they fly, you can take a nestling. And separate him from anybody else from his flock. He knows how to go south. So they've learned where the North Star is while they were nestlings, apparently from observing the sky. They have no possibility of learning this from their parents or somebody else who knows. Okay, so how do they do it? Well, Emlin solved that problem as well. Basically, because the Earth rotates on the axis of roughly north, the sky rotates counter to north. So north is roughly the center of rotation of the night sky. So if evolution built into indigo buntings the capacity to recognize the night sky and analyze the area of rotation, the nestlings could extract the information of what north is. And there's a critical period for this. They have to do it while they're nestlings. If they don't learn it while they're nestlings, they never learn it. And that's what Emlin showed, that is exactly what they do. Because what he did was he took nestlings and he raised them in planetaria and he made totally arbitrary night skies. You could make any constellation you want. You can make them rotate around any center of rotation you want. So he did that with different arbitrary things, and then he waited until it was time for them to fly south or north, let them go, and they head out the very first time they fly north or south relative to the center of rotation of the night sky. Okay, that's a domain of core knowledge. There are representations that have the content of north and night sky. It's a domain-specific learning mechanism. It learns nothing else other than north. It doesn't help the birds learn what to eat, who to mate with, anything else. Evolution built that in to solve one problem, a learning problem, and one problem alone. So it's a paradigm example of a domain-specific learning mechanism. There have to be innate input analyzers that tell the animal what the sky is, what to be analyzing in terms of north. Once they've learned north, those input analyzers enable them to identify the night sky all the way through life, and this continues. It doesn't continue to support learning anymore, but it continues to support knowing where to go when it's summer and winter throughout their lifespan. So it continues to operate throughout the lifespan. Okay, that's what I mean by core knowledge. And the question is, are people different from every other animal? I could have given you 47 examples, 470 examples. There are many, many examples in the ethology literature for animals. It would be really strange if we were the only animal that didn't have systems of knowledge like that. It's possible we are, but it would be really strange if we are. So the question that I'm interested in is, do we have systems of knowledge like that? And if so, which ones are they? What are the domains of human core knowledge? And I think that you'll hear from Elizabeth Spelke, and she'll be telling you about human core knowledge of number. The chapter you read today was about a proposal that there's a human core knowledge of intentional agency, the notion of a person as an intentional agent. The notions of goals and attentional states are supported by innate domain-specific input analyzers. Other examples of core knowledge are Michaud it's contact causality, the notion of an object.
You should explain that, because they haven't read about Michaud, and you use it as an adjective.
Okay, right. Well, contrary to the Piaget's position that concepts of causality and objects have to be constructed from sensory motor primitives. A contrary proposal is that the concept of causality is innate part of core knowledge, as is the concept of object. I don't know if anybody's going to present that case study. What Michaud causality is this. If I show you this, I assume, interpreted that I caused this thing to move, right? Now, there's a spatial-temporal analysis, a psychophysical analysis of what the spatial-temporal relations have to be between my motion and this motion for you to see it as causal. So that's the domain-specific analyzer, the perceptual analyzer, which analyzes spatial-temporal relations among events. And if certain conditions are met, outputs cause. And there's evidence that babies see such events as causal as well. So that's a proposal. I'm not going to, obviously don't have time to give you the kind of evidence in support of this. I'm just saying that the core knowledge, intentionality, and agency case study that you read is just one of several case studies of domains of human knowledge that have these properties that I'm claiming are properties of core knowledge. Okay, so that's placing this work in a context. Now, the question is, are you convinced? Okay, you read this chapter, you read the kind of evidence that I take as evidence that babies in fact do have representations with the content of goal or attention or perception or agent, right? So, but that's really what we should be fighting about, because there is an alternative interpretation of each of those experiments. As I say, this is an empirical claim, right? I mean, it's not a matter of logic that these concepts are innate. They could be learned, but notice, a theory of learning would have to say what the innate concepts were, maybe sensory primitives, and then what the mechanisms that you get these out of them, right? So that's the alternative, that you have some other concepts that don't have any of the content of the concept of intentional agency, and a learning mechanism that operates on them and yields them. The alternative is these concepts themselves are part of core knowledge, innate. So that's the debate I want us to engage in here. So let's take the concept of goal first. The capacity to represent the actions of others as in terms of the goals of those agents. Okay. Let's start with let's take children 18 months and younger. Okay. We will get to the question of, if this is innate, why are we not finding evidence for this until 6 or 9 months? Right. So we'll get to that question. But let's look at the evidence for it from 18 months younger. So let's just try to, I want to convince, I think the evidence is overwhelming that certainly children between 12 months and 18 months represent others' actions in terms of other people's goals. I think the evidence is strong for 6 to 12 months as well. So I want to just make sure that you see what that evidence is. So, you read it. Give me a piece of evidence that babies represent other people or other agents in terms of the agent's goals. What would convince you of that? Well, once we get the evidence on the board, we will then, I'll try to engage you in the counter arguments and then the counter to the counter arguments. But first, So hold your objections now. Engage in the process of what counts as evidence that babies understand other people in terms of their goals.
I think the whisk experiment that you talked about in the unfinished
state. The whisk experiment is really about their understanding of symbols as referential. Right, so the whisk experiment isn't really about the goals of agents, the goals of actions.
I mean, I understand that part, but isn't it also, I think it's maybe hard to see.
Well, that's actually important, of course. But
you ask the kids to point out the whisk, you know, they're separating, I mean, they are in some sense judging what your intention of the question is.
Right. Sure. Yes, in fact, I mean, that's actually a very important point. The fact is that the notion of goal and the notion of referential intent, or communicative intent, are not unrelated, right? They're interdefined. And, of course, that's one of the reasons to believe that these concepts actually have this context, because they're interrelated in children's behavior as well from as early as you can see them. So I agree with you that they are related. But let's take goals much more broadly, much more baldly.
Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed the one where the babies watch somebody make a light go, and they.
That's the best one. Yeah.
That these little beings could watch somebody make it light up with their head, that their hands are like just not doing anything.
Yeah.
And then when their hands were, I think the example was they acted like they were cold.
That's right.
The logic was that, well, their hands are busy, so that's why they use their hands.
That's right.
Of course they use their hands if they were available. And that's just amazing. That little sequence.
Yeah, those are 14-month-old babies. That's my favorite experiment in the literature, actually. But it's an experiment by the group that includes Gergay and Cisbra, who do all the looking time experiments with computer-animated objects as well. I mean, I think that they're the most brilliant experimenters in this domain. We replicated some of their studies, but do you all remember that experiment and understand the force of it? I mean, one issue is that does babies' capacity to imitate already depend upon their analyzing the goals of the actions of others? And you could argue that you could have a rich interpretation of imitation or a leaner one, which just simply says there's just a human, you know, reflex to imitate, right? But this experiment suggests they absolutely are analyzing the goals of the actions. So remember that the experiment was that you demonstrate for babies, and this was originally done by Meltzoff, who's also one of my heroes in this literature, with 18-month-olds, that if you do that to make a light go on and then give it to the baby does that. So he imitates the means as well as the action. And then what Sisbra said, but wait a minute, this could be something much more sophisticated, because the way they originally did it is the way I just did. The hands were like this. And so the babies might be reasoning, well, if they could do it with his hands, why would he have done it with his head? So they did exactly what you said. The experimenter pretended to be cold. They put a blanket around them and holding it like this when he did this. Now you give it to the babies, and the babies go like this. Okay, so that's a gorgeous experiment.
The Woodward experiment,
Right. So there's a whole series of experiments of that sort where you habituate the baby to, I'll give you another example. It was actually the one that Woodward built, modeled these on, an experiment by Elizabeth Spelke and Phillips. But in their version, there are two objects there. You turn, you smile, you pick up this object, you go like this. And you habituate the baby to that. Then after the babies have gotten completely bored with that, you switch the objects, or you don't switch the objects, it doesn't matter. You turn and you smile at the other one, and you then either pick up the one you're not looking at, but was the one that you picked up before. Okay, so you're now holding the same object that the babies have been bored to death of seeing you hold. However, now it wasn't the one that you looked and smiled at before you did it, or you pick up the one that you looked and smiled at, but which is a different object than they saw before. And in these experiments, babies look longer at what seems to be the bizarre event. And here, again, they look longer at the bizarre event, where you pick up something that you didn't look and smile at. So that suggests that both, again, the integration of the referential interpretation of looking, right, as signaling what a goal is, but also analyzing the goal of the reach. So that's consistent with the Woodward experiments. So those experiments, I think, indeed, I would interpret them exactly as I do in the chapter. Yes?
I have a question about the concept of goal.
Sure, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
In our discussion and in the paper, there's an unavoidable layering on of maybe extra meaning of goal. And we talk about goal and the idea of principle of rationality that is sort of the underlying mechanism for what, if I interpret it correctly, is
for explaining action. Yeah.
I guess my question is there a conceptualization of what the concept of goal is for the baby and the infant or whatever? And really, when we say principle of rationality, are we're talking about like logical rationality that we exercise? And obviously, that's
yeah.
That is no, but I don't have a very good feel for that concept of goal.
Right. I mean, that's a terrific question, because there is a real problem in this work of when you use language to characterize the content of the representations that the babies have, you have no choice but using the language that you have. That leaves you open to the problem of theory-laden attribution. We have a concept of a goal, which is embedded in a full-blown want-belief intentional psychology, right? We understand people's actions not only in terms of their goals, but in terms of a representational account of their beliefs and desires, which then becomes part of how we think about goals. That is a completely dead right on question. And what Gergay and Sisber are doing with their principle of rationality is the analysis of goal they're giving is that they think is supported by the evidence in the babies is really exhausted by what they call the principle of rationality, which they explain, right? So they're absolutely giving you an analysis that tells you what they mean by rationality and what they mean by goal, and how these experiments say that under that sense of meaning it, right? So go back to the indigo bunting case. I said that the indigo buntings have a representation of the night sky and a representation of north. Well, I had to use words. But obviously they don't have the same notion of north that we do. But we can say what the content of their representation is by characterizing what it is in the world that triggers it and what computations it enters into, right? So it enters into deciding and only deciding where to fly under certain hormonal things. And so it's in that sense, in that weak sense, that they have concepts with the content night sky and north. But that's enough of overlap with our concepts. I mean, you have to be really precise. Okay, so here's the analysis of goal that we're attributing to babies in this experiment. Basically, there's an intentional relationship between an agent and an object. The agent has some disposition with respect to that object, to want it, to get it, right? That's the goal, to turn the light on, right? The baby analyzes the relations between agents and entities in the world and the environment, right? That's the point of the hands on the side and things like that. From the point of view of a principle of rationality, which is that other things being equal, you take the most efficient action with respect to that goal. And that's it, right? Now that's certainly all of those are part of our notion of goal, which is why it's not a mistake to call it goal, even though we have a much richer notion of goal embedded in a theory which I think doesn't get developed until age 3 or 4. Yeah.
Right. So then just a non-experiment. What if you have a pad that's, say, at the child's foot, and you demonstrate to light it by your hand? Principle of rationality would indicate to me that the child would take the path of touching it with their foot. The question is, do they touch it with their foot or with their hand? And would they touch it with their hand because they're used to interacting in the world with their hands? And I don't know exactly where that lies.
Well, it depends upon what they, according to the Gergay analysis, it depends upon their analysis of why you touched it with your foot, right? So if there were, this is exactly analogous to the touching it with your head. Right? I mean, they do imitate touching with the head, even though they're very used to touching things with hands, if they can't explain why you didn't touch it with your hands. So it's not, the point is, that's showing that they're analyzing these things exactly in terms of these distinctions and concepts. Right? So that's exactly why these experiments support their analysis of the use of the principle of rationality to make sense of other people's actions. Right?
Mm-hmm. Another experiment that I thought proved that, in fact, one that kind of convinced me along with the head and hand touching, was the one about the pegs and trying to put the rings on the pegs.
Yeah.
The fact that the children were replicating what was supposed to happen, not what they actually saw.
That's right. That's also a Meltzoff experiment.
Yeah.
Those are 18-month-olds, right? But that's...
How did they get that?
Well, again, so they're able to analyze somehow, but they're able, so here's what the input analyzers are doing, right? They're analyzing somehow the what would be the equal, you know, they're able to analyze the fact that there's this repetitive motion to somehow infer what the goal of that motion was. Then that's what they imitate. Right. Yeah, those are gorgeous experiments, too. Those are 18-month-olds. But those experiments have exactly the same structure as the Garrigue looking time experiments. So now they're not imitation now. Again, we're now going back to looking time as a dependent measure. These are the experiments that I do early in the chapter, where what happens is a little ball comes off the... It's a little ball that takes that motion. And after it's like right about here, a big ball comes on from here and follows it. This is a small thing here. And then it goes around and goes off like that. So that's what the babies see that over and over again. Now, when you see that, I know because we've asked adults to describe what they see this big ball as chasing the little ball, trying to catch the little ball. There's the goal in there. Right? They don't see the goal here. They have to infer the goal because they never see him catching. Right? So again, there's an input analyzer that must represent the contingency between these two things and the barrier to interpret that goal. If that's indeed how the babies are representing it, the question is, what's the evidence that babies are representing it that way? Well, there's a whole bunch of evidence. One bit of evidence is that after they've been habituated to that, you can then, quote, show them the ending. And in one ending, this little one stops short, and this big one either just passes right by it or actually comes up and catches it. And they think it's bizarre if it, they look longer. I'm over-interpreting the results. They look longer if it passes right by. Another thing that shows that they're analyzing the environmental constraints, remember that's part of the rational analysis as well, is that you habituated them to what I've just shown you, and now you make the barrier have this great big gap. So now either the ball does this, and then the big ball either just follows right after it or goes around. And now they think it's very bizarre, or they look longer, if it makes the same motion that they saw before. And they look less if it takes the rational action towards that goal again. So they're interpreting that these patterns of looking, that the baby is imposing the analysis that's in this minimal sense of goal. But minimal but real, I think it deserves to be called a sense of goal. Right? So those are the kinds of experiments that that altogether show that preverbal infants already see the actions of even discs. Right? It doesn't have to look like a person to attribute a goal to it. It has to move like a person. Right? It has to react contingently to its world the way an agent would in order to trigger, to elicit these representations in terms of a goals, attentional states, environmental constraints towards achieving the goals, etc. Okay, so that's the form of... that's the form of the evidence that babies have these intentional attributions. Okay. Now, questions? Yeah.
I'm interested in the looking time for the bizarre thing. So those, over time, if you show the child to that, would they look longer? The bizarre thing? Does that go, I mean, over time, if you show the same one?
Oh, yeah. That's the other way. It's much stronger the first time you've shown it, and by the third time you've shown it, they said, okay, well, this is how it works in this situation. So it's not like this is some kind of impossible thing that they always are puzzled it happens. So these experiments, you tend to have a big difference between the expected and unexpected outcome on the first pair of times you see them, less the second and gone by the third.
Is that not the pattern in a sort of violation of physical laws type of experiments where something falls through a barrier?
That's the same pattern.
Okay, so they also, even though that's sort of a violation of some physical law,
yeah.
They also...
Yeah, if you show them it, over and over again, yeah, basically the perception wins, right? So they God knows how they interpret it, right? But they cease to look longer at it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is there any evidence for where these input analyzers are in the brain? Or are they neural networks, and is it consistent?
There's not work on babies, but there's lots of evidence of where they are. I can't imagine what they would be other than neural networks, right? I mean, we don't even have any other ontology of how states of the brain could be representing something of this sort. But there are circuits that involve the parietal temporal junction and the frontal lobes that show up in imaging studies. You can do imaging studies of these kinds of geometric figure moving things, and if they are moving in a way that we interpret them as we and the subjects, these are adult subjects, interpret them as intentional, different circuits light up than if they move in a way that we interpret them as mechanical motion.
Those are consistent among adults.
Yes. Yeah. It's one of these. You can do these region of interest analyses where you use one of these tasks to identify the area in a particular person. They're all roughly in the same area, and then you can do a whole series of studies to see exactly what computations that area is doing. But again. We wouldn't expect this to be any other place in the brain. In the brain, it's not in the big toe or the heart, right? And even if it weren't the case that it were localized, that wouldn't change the empirical evidence that such representations exist. I mean, they could be widely distributed, so you wouldn't be able to see them in an imaging experiment or see them in brain damage, right? There are also specific brain lesions, and some people think autism is a developmental disorder which has impaired the intentional this domain of core knowledge, among other things. So, in fact, the evidence does seem it is localized to some degree.
Have any of these specific experiments been done with autistic children?
Yes, not these ones. But the ones that have to do with perception and reference. So the experiment that was in the chapter about the whisk, that's actually done by a graduate student of mine who's interested in autism. And the question she's asking is, and we haven't talked about the referential part of intentionality, understanding not people's goals with respect to things in the world, but people's capacity to refer to things in the world, such that their points refer to things in the world, their looks refer to things in the world, and their language refers to things in the world. So the evidence that very young children understand certain aspects of people's behavior as referential is also part of this domain of intentionality, which is why these experiments are relevant to both. Dare Baldwin's lovely experiments where you wait until the baby is looking at a novel object that the baby's never seen before, and you say, oh, that's a whisk. And what normal babies do, even 13-month-olds, is as soon as they hear a novel word, they look up to your eyes. So they don't assume that even though this thing is a very good candidate for a new name, because they're looking at a novel object and they've never heard the name for it, they don't assume when you said whisk that you're referring to that. They look up to your eyes, and if you happen to be looking in a bucket, so they can't even see what the whisk is, by 16, 18 months, are able to make the mapping between the word and an object they haven't even seen before, which was the object of your referential intent. So this is showing the integration of eye gaze with language as a referential entity. Okay, autistic adults fail that task, and autistic children fail that task. And they also fail the whisk task that is in this chapter, where you teach them a new word about a picture. You say, "This, have you ever heard of a whisk? This is a whisk." And you just teach them associatively about the picture. This is a whisk, this is a whisk, this is a whisk. Now, if you give a normal 18-month-old now a choice between that picture of a whisk and a real whisk and say, "Give me the whisk," they don't give you the picture, right? So they've understood that the picture is a symbol as well as the word is a symbol. Autistic people give you the picture. Okay, so, and it's interrelated with the ones who follow the gaze. There's variation in autism. So that work does, I mean, there's lots of work of that sort that supports, that suggests that one of the things that is part of the autistic syndrome is in fact damaged to exactly the system of core knowledge. Yeah, questions?
I remember the discussion of gaze following and its emergence at a particular age. I don't remember, was it?
But between 6 and 9 months.
And that the reason it didn't emerge before that was not because it wasn't there, but was because of the competing stimulus of the face. Right?
That's right. They can't have problems disengaging attention, right?
Do you have similar thoughts about the emergence of other intentions?
Yeah. So now we're getting to the question of, okay, if this is innate, why is it so late, right? So many of these experiments, you don't get any evidence for the kids doing them till like 9 months. And even gaze following, you don't get robustly until, you can get it 7 to 9 months, but it's quite robust by 9 to 12 months. This is certainly a challenge. If this is supposed to be innate, why aren't you seeing this sooner? What I say in the chapter is that there's four answers to that question. One is sometimes there's some performance factor that prevents the demonstration of the knowledge, and the gaze following example is an example in this case, an example of that in this domain, which is that very young babies, if they're looking at something, have a very hard time disengaging attention, and they'll actually often start crying. They're sitting there, they're clearly tired of looking at it, and they start to cry as a mechanism to disengage attention. And so if you're looking at a baby and you do like this, in order for the baby to turn and look like this, they have to look away from you, right? And so they might know that they might understand your gaze just exactly the way we would, that you change their attention because there's something to look at over here, but they don't follow it because they can't disengage from your face. And that's what the Bruce Hood experiment showed is true. Even 2-month-olds, if you're showing them a video of a face and then the eyes switch over here and you take the face off at the same time, then the baby switched their attention to over here at 2 months. Okay, so, he does a wonderful control, which I take credit for because I was reviewer on this paper, and I said, this is wonderful, but how do you know any kind of motion of the face wouldn't have sent them this way? So, I suggest, why don't you do tongue protrusion? So, they did an experiment where the baby's looking at the face, and they don't follow the tongue, right? So the idea is that doesn't show, of course, that they're making any intentional attribution. It could just be a reflex at that point. But at any rate, it says that gaze following can be elicited far earlier than the 7 to 9 months, and gives an explanation of why it isn't. In none of the other cases do we have anything of that sort, right? So that's not a general answer to why these Gergay experiments don't work until then, or why the Woodward Reach experiments aren't robust until 6 or 7 months, etc. But what I said is that there's two other ways of understanding late development. One is maturational, right? I mean, there's the circuit that underlies these representations that involves the frontal lobes, and we know that frontal development is incredibly protracted and really massive in the second half of the first years of life. I mean, that's sort of Adele Diamond's work, which have you done or will you do? Yeah, right. So So the point is, the fact that something emerges relatively late in infancy doesn't mean it's learned. Right? It could well be subserved by some maturational process. The third thing is, even though you might have the schema of analyzing actions in terms of this rationality constraint, in terms of goals and environmental constraints, you still have to learn about the particular goals of particular agents. I mean, this is a learning device, right? It isn't that there's no learning. It's that what the claim is that what is not learned is the concept of a goal itself, right? But particular goals, of course, I mean, babies aren't born knowing that you make something go on. If you have such a goal, you have to do such and such an action, right? There's all of the things in the world, just like the indigo bunting is born with a learning device to learn about north. What the claim here is the baby is built with a learning device to learn about classes of intentional agents, classes of actions, and classes of goals, right? But what they don't have to learn is the very notion of a goal itself. That's the claim. Right? So all of those are ways of thinking about it. But the final argument there's two final arguments, let's stop this one and turn to conceptual change. There's two final arguments that makes me convinced that this is a domain of core knowledge. Okay. One is that if it isn't, we are up against the following problem, which is babies must have some spatial-temporal representations, some sensory-motor representations. We know they have those. No one denies they have those. And they must somehow be able to create a representation of goal, agent, and rationality out of them. Right? There's a learning problem. If you are only going to give them perceptual primitives, you have to tell me a story of how you take perceptual primitives as an input and end up with a representation that has the content goal, which cannot be defined in sensory primitives. So I believe that there are such mechanisms. In fact, that's the point about the conceptual change, right? But I don't believe they're available to infants. When you see what I think the mechanisms underlying conceptual change are, they're not going to be available to infants. So until you even give me a candidate theory of, this is a classic learnability argument, and it's essentially Fodor's argument for nativism, but it's also all the rationalists, Kant's, everybody's argument, is that if you think that you start out only with sensory motor primitives and you end up with a concept of lie, you have to tell me how you get the concept of lie out of a stock of representations that don't have any intentionality. I mean, what is the concept of a lie? It's something you say with the intent of causing a belief in somebody else that isn't true. Right? Notice all the intentional language to even give what the definition of a lie is. You try to do that in terms of sensory motor primitives. You try to give me a definition of lie in terms of sensory motor primitives. Believe me, you're not going to be able to do it. And that's why I'm convinced that I know that kids come to understand the concept of lie, not until they're five or so, because I think it requires further developments in the theory of mind. But the start of the developments of the theory of mind is already there in infancy. So there's a learnability argument that makes me, that convinces me. Yeah?
I have a question going back to something you said earlier about if you show an irrational event over and over, that a child will habituate to that. So is what you're saying that even with these innate tendencies, or whatever you want to call them, if the environment was such, that might be overridden by environment? So in other words, what was the bird? Could the environment mess up that bird so it would fly the wrong way?
Sure, if you could change the sky, right? So if you make the sky rotate around and you change the configuration, the birds are going to be sunk, right? So all of these things are... The way evolution works, if it builds representations, the capacity for representations, basically there's a range of environments that these representations are adapted to. So if you actually provided environments that weren't consistent with that, then these representations wouldn't know what to do, right? But in the case of irrational actions over and over again, if you show them over and over again, the baby just takes that as evidence that that the goal was, basically, equal potentiality, doing the same thing over and over again, is one of the cues that there's a goal here, right? So it's just, the baby can just, doesn't have to throw over the notion that people have goals. It's just that they were wrong about what the goal would be. So that's not a, that's the kind of thing that this learning device is built to learn, right? So babies have to learn what the rational actions are and what the environmental constraints are. And the full story of how this works would be to characterize how these input analyzers work, right? So that's not an example of really messing the thing up.
Susan, on this issue of how do you get from spatial temporal analysis to goals and intentions, are there any cues from the primate literature, particularly the difference between monkeys and chimps, about what might happen that reveals what the crucial ingredient is that, I don't know whether it's chimps and monks or dogs and monkeys or where the dividing line comes, but what the crucial ingredient might be, which, so to speak, coalesces the goal system?
Ask Mark that when he comes. But the whole issue of whether primates actually have these intentional attributions is really up in, really, really a hot topic in the primate literature now. So certainly with Povinelli and Tomasello of 5 years ago, the answer was that's one of the big divides between non-human primates, even chimps, and us. But there's a lot of evidence now that that's not true. Although it may well be that the domains which you can elicit are, it's much more encapsulated in particular domains like competitive situations for chimpanzees, etc. But the point is, I think that that's a really relevant question and kind of analysis to do. But it isn't clear that the evolutionary ingredients would be the possible answer to a learning story, right? The point is, the mechanisms by which evolution builds something out of something else aren't necessarily anything like the mechanism by which learning builds something out of something else, right? I think the evolutionary story is a really important part of this, because if you think that some set of representations is innate, you need a story of how evolution could have built that. And comparative cognition is the way to get evidence with respect to testing that story. And so, for example, if you look at something like the dance of the bees, bees go out, find some wonderful source of nectar, come back, and do a particular dance, which is this wiggle dance that goes in a figure eight, and the axis of the figure eight tells you the direction with respect to the sun of where to fly, and the speed by which they wiggle tells you how far to go. And so the other bees go behind it, and they take off and go find the bee. So this is work of von Fisch. It's another wonderful little bit of very encapsulated representations. Now, there's a question of how that could ever have evolved. Right? Bees don't have to learn that. They just know innately how to do the dance and how to interpret the dance. How could that have evolved? Well, people came up with proposals for how it could evolve, and then they found other bees that had the subcomponents, right? So that's a really elegant analysis, giving the kind of analysis you want. But that doesn't say anything about that a given bee who has to learn that, right? In fact, we know that the bees don't have to learn that, right? So that's it's a different question. It's a different but related question.
When you talk about having to construct the concept of goal out of sort of sensory motor information, I mean, to some degree, I think that we're sort of taking a sort of extreme empiricist position. Is it not possible that there are sort of more domain general, non-modular, innate mechanisms, perhaps, that govern our abilities as humans or as primates or wherever you want to draw the line to attribute some type of intentionality and then use experience to actually create or build up the concept of goal? Like, I don't necessarily buy into the fact that goal itself has to be part of core knowledge. I might buy it just the way that we have a mechanism or bias towards trying to make sense of things that then based on some sensory motor building blocks, we then build it up. But to suggest that to be...
Wait. Okay, look. The point is, if we have a bias to make sense of things, okay, the question is, what's the... I agree that there's all kinds of domain general learning mechanisms, and in fact, I'm not sure that the learning in these domains... This might be a disanalogy to the Indigo Buntic case, right? So I'm not sure that the learning mechanisms in this domain are domain-specific ones. Absolutely, there's no evidence for that, right? They could be quite domain general learning mechanisms. But the question is, what are the representations over which they're operating? So are they operating over representations that already have content like goal? Or are they operating on something else? Now, I agree with you that when the alternative you just posed is exactly the kind of analysis one wants to do. But you need to tell me what candidate something less than goal could be. And the empiricist proposal is that it will be something like contingency, things that could be specified in spatial-temporal terms, which can be very complicated. Contingency, paths. I mean, there's all kinds of spatial-temporal primitives which are relevant to this because they're going to be part of characterizing what the input analyzers are in my story. Right? I mean,
why do we have to restrict ourselves only to spatial-temporal? But I mean, I know it's the main something for white people. Can we talk about some innate?
What would they be, though? Tell me what they would be. That's the alternative story. So the point is, appealing to something domain general doesn't... Remember, we're interested in conceptual content here, right? So I completely agree with you about the learning mechanisms, the associative mechanisms, their causal analyses that might apply very general. I mean, I don't know what all of the learning mechanisms are. They may be quite domain general. Certainly the bootstrapping mechanisms that I'm talking about in the second paper we're going to now turn to are domain general learning mechanisms. But here what we're interested in is where the content of the concepts come from. And either they already have some intentional content already, the building blocks already have some intentional content anyway. And the notion of goal that we have here is a very minimal one, as is the notion of referential intention. It's just the capacity to attend to something in the world. Those are what I am proposing are the two primitives out of which you build a much richer one. If you think that you can do it with some other primitives that are less than that, I'm not going to listen to you until you have a proposal for what they are, right? That is exactly the enterprise, right? I don't think there's going to be any. I think those are the rock bottom ones here. But you're right. I mean, that's exactly the enterprise. And if you could come up with one, We could think of experiments to test it, and you would have a good career ahead of yourself. Yes.
Real quick, the idea of goal, would you consider that to be domain-specific?
Yes, because it's domain-specific in the sense that it's interrelated with the notion of intentional agent and perceptual state. So the domain here is the domain of intent. So it's not, you know, it's not the goal.
The domain of intention.
Exactly, that's the domain. That's the domain, right. And that's also one of the things that makes me believe that this actually is a system of core knowledge, which is that these concepts appear to develop in concert, right? As soon as you get evidence for one, you get evidence for the other, and the same baby in the same experiment, which is an argument against the view that you're doing some kind of piecemeal learning over some primitives that are unrelated to each, to that domain, right? So that's an that's the interrelations among these concepts is part, an important part of both characterizing what their content is, right, but also of the evidence that we're interpreting these behavior, the baby's behaviors in the right way. So that's the domain. The domain is intentional agency. And so it's domain specific because these only have meaning in that domain. Right? It's a kind of trivial claim to call it these domain specific. But nonetheless, that's the sense in domains, circular in a way. But it's not a vicious circular, it's a necessary circularity. Because your concepts get their content. We know what their concepts are in terms of their interrelations with other concepts. And then those system of interrelations tell you what the domain is.
Part two.
Right. I have half an hour to do conceptual change. Okay. So. There is on this story an innate concept that is going to give part of the meaning of the concept of a person to a baby, because a person is going to trigger all of these input analyzers that have to do with intentionality, right? Presumably, the reason we have, if this is true, the reason we have core knowledge of intentional agents is to help us make sense of the behavior of people. Those are probably the agents that this was designed to, by evolution, to understand. In some sense, in that sense, babies have an innate concept of person. But as I said, it's an empirical question what the domains of core knowledge are. And many people have argued that there's core knowledge of the domain of intuitive biology as well. That evolution has built us not only with a concept of intentional agency, but also with a concept or an intuitive framework theory of living things. And the argument for this is partly an evolutionary just-so story, which is the biological world is really important for human survival. After all, to understand the biological world, you know, our ancestors were hunters. To be a hunter, you need to be a good ecologist. And you have to be able to understand the natural world. I find that kind of evolutionary just-so story completely non-convincing. Right? What we really need, if we want to say that there's innate knowledge of animals as biological beings, is evidence of the sort that we're talking about here. And there ain't any, folks. There aren't any innate input analyzers that identify biological beings. There might be innate analyzers animals certainly are going to trigger the intentional agency analyzers if disks can. You know, a dog that you're interacting with and whose behavior you can understand perfectly well in terms of goals is going to be represented by you as an agent. So the babies can certainly learn concepts of animal kinds as kinds of agents. So they're going to have a concept of animal in some sense because animals are agents. But agent isn't the same thing as biological being. Right? So this is a case of a theory-laden attribution. If you say kids can distinguish animals from vehicles, therefore they have a biological concept, namely animal. Right? But that's, you know, that's exactly the mistake we don't want to make. Right? Because we have to say what the content of that concept is and in what sense it's a biological concept. And the argument in the second chapter that you read was that to create the first framework theory, the first domain-specific conceptual system that has any biological content, first of all, it's not done until kids are around six. Somewhere between four and six. It's not over until, it's not really consolidated until kids are around 10, right? So, the argument is that doing this goes beyond core knowledge. You create concepts that you couldn't even represent in the core knowledge system. So this is the flip side of the argument that I started with. I said, core knowledge has these properties. It's constant through development, and it's innate, et cetera, conceptual content. Now I'm going to say, yes, there are systems of core knowledge that have those properties, and intentional agency is one. But human beings have the capacity to create new conceptual content that is radically, radically different from what the systems of core knowledge are like. It's radically different in the sense it's incommensurable. That is, the child who has created the first vitalist biology can think thoughts that aren't even expressible in terms of the concepts that a three-year-old has. And that's the strongest sense of that you can imagine of a real kind of discontinuity in conceptual content. Right? So the worked example I give in the second chapter is intuitive biology, and I chose that one. Again, there are many, many examples of this sort. From this age, you can look at Piaget's conservation experiments in this way. So what's changing are not domain general reasoning abilities, as Piaget thought, but intuitive theory, not that those could be changing too, but the right analysis of the conservation phenomena is the underlying change in the child's theory of matter. Or there's work on children's developing understanding of the earth and the relation between the earth and the sun and the planets, sort of a new ontology of sort of cosmology. The development of the notion of rational number, fractions, requires a conceptual change of these sorts. So these are common kinds of changes, and they're really, really important in education. They're the ones that where you tell the kids something and they understand it in terms of the concepts they already had, and it went literally in one ear and out the other. Right? And this is giving a principled reason of why that's so, because you said something that used concepts that you represent. They can't even represent the concepts to understand the sentence that you said. This is the fundamental problem of science education and math education. So conceptual change, I'm arguing here, not only exists, but is terribly important. And the argument of the point of this chapter is to give an analysis, this three-point three-part chapter. Give an analysis of what we mean by conceptual change. Show you that this is a case that satisfies it. So I'm doing exactly what I did parallel to what I did in the intentionality chapter. Give you analysis of core knowledge, and then give you an example and what kind of evidence supports it. Here I'm giving an analysis of conceptual change, and then giving you analysis of what kind of evidence supports that there is a change of this sort. And then at the end, saying, okay, how do we think about the mechanisms that allow this, right? So, yes, there is core knowledge, but there is also the capacity to create genuinely new concepts. How do we think about that? But what do we do? How do children solve the problem. This is Fodor's problem in his work on innateness. I don't know if you did this part of his modularity stuff, which is his argument that this can't happen. As I say, this is where I part company with Fodor. He says this can't happen. Changes of this sort are logically impossible because you cannot learn what you can't already represent. Right? Now, I gave you an argument of that sort. That was what I gave in answer to your question. Right? So now I'm going to say, but it does sometimes happen.
Is the reason that you're more satisfied doing this because you actually have proposed mechanisms that can go from
conceptual change? So I think I understand something about what the mechanisms are, and I think they actually aren't available to babies, which is one of the reasons that I don't think a story of the sort you were going to try to do would work.
Can I give you a specific example?
Sure.
You know this experiment you have behind you on the board where there's a small and large hole?
Mm-hmm.
They talk in a follow-up experiment that, you know, babies will, you know, dishabituate to a large ball going around when the hole is obviously big enough for it to go through.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's sort of taken for granted, I think, in this literature as being sort of another area of core knowledge. They know just sort of a natural law that, not from experience because they're too young.
No.
That wasn't the main point of the argument. The main point of the argument was that they would find it illogical that the big ball is
sure, sure.
Path to get through.
Mm-hmm.
But inherent in that is the degree to which, if they're at such a young age where they've never seen objects in the real world with spaces like that, then
my question
is, how do they know that, and how do you compare that with the conservation of liquid, and then how would you justify being able to go from one to the other? One case, but not the other.
Yeah, I mean, the claim here is not absolutely not that they haven't, that in order to analyze the environmental constraints, you have to have had experience. They could well have learned that. Right.
Okay.
Yeah, right. The claim of what they haven't learned, the question is the goal behind it.
It was somewhere in there.
No, I did make that argument in that. I mean, the point is, that is the look. But now, see, now you're pushing the empiricist alternative. You could explain all of these experiments in terms of generalizations formulated over spatial-temporal vocabulary, right? That is the alternative.
But my use of the analogy is not actually interested in the goal, but just in terms of the actual observation of physical phenomena of natural laws.
Sure.
And how, when we are talking about conceptual change in terms of Piaget's, you know, conservation of liquid, how you're going to provide mechanisms and say this is actually qualitative change, but how do we get from sensor motor to their sort of
I'm not going to do the weight density case. I mean, I could have done that instead of the biology. Let's stick to the biology case because that's the one you read. But the argument here is not that the conceptual change is going from perceptual motor primitives to an intuitive biology, but rather it's going from the notion of an animal as an agent to an animal as a biological being. Right. So the input to the conceptual change, you have to characterize. Okay, look, let me give you the claim here. The idea is you have conceptual system one, you have conceptual system two. The idea is that there are episodes in development where we can characterize a set of interrelated concepts that the child has at a certain time. And we can characterize a later point where there's another set of interrelated concepts that share some domain of phenomena. I mean, there's going to be new phenomena that are included in this, but in order for it to be conceptual change, there has to be some domain of phenomena where they common. And basically what one has to do is to characterize what those concepts are. One has to say what the concept of an animal is in CS1, or what the nearest thing to the notion of alive is in CS1. And the claim is that there are episodes in development where the concepts here cannot be expressed in terms of the concepts here, or vice versa. Okay. That claim is neutral to whether these are sensory, you know, an example of such change is from the phlogiston theory of burning to the oxygen theory of burning. But that change is not from a sensory motor to a concept, it's a change within theories. Right? So we're in the fully conceptual realm here. This is a set of concepts. It's an intuitive theory with a certain structure articulated in a certain set of concepts, and here's a different one. And so the worked example in this chapter is this is a vitalist biology. Okay. Which I'll lay out for you what the structure... I mean, what you have to do with this analysis is actually say what the concepts are here, and what the concepts are here... Then say why they're qualitatively different. If you really think that there are episodes of true conceptual change, you have to give me a description of the conceptual system at time one, the conceptual system of time two, and why they are qualitatively different. That's what this analysis is. Then what you want to do is to say what on earth mechanism could take you from here to there. Okay? And so that's what this research program is. We could have stuck within the intuitive biology, the intentionality one, taken the infant's intentional understanding and the four-year-old's fully representational theory of mind as an example of such a change, right? So the point is, again, this is what educators do whenever they try to analyze the misconceptions of, cases of systematic misconceptions of children in some domain where you're trying to teach them something. So sometimes children's misconceptions are the reflection of a systematic alternative theory, right? Which is really incommensurable with the language that you're describing the phenomena that you're talking to them about, right? And if there are such things as educators, you better know when you're in the face of one, because it's hard to get these kinds of changes, as it should be, because everything you say formulated in this language, they can't even represent. And so that poses the learning problem really broadly. If so, how the hell do you get them from here to here? Okay, so that's what what I'm claiming is there. Again, now it's an empirical claim again. There are episodes in conceptual development that have this structure. The intuitive biology cases I'm offering as one. And we can give an analysis of how these are qualitatively different, and we can say something about what the mechanisms of change are. Okay, so that's what we have 20 minutes to do. The vitalist biology that children construct somewhere by 6 or 7 it's organized around the notion of a living thing. It includes both animals and plants as living things. And living things are really different from intentional agents, as noticed by the fact that a plant can be one, right? For the preschooler who doesn't have the notion of a living thing, plants are fundamentally different kinds of things than animals, because animals are intentional agents and plants are not. But when you've constructed a notion of a living thing, you can coalesce what were ontologically distinct concepts into a single superordinate concept. The vitalist biology is the following. It's kind of shallow, but it's also pretty complicated. There are living things have as a goal, but not an intentional goal, to stay alive. The opposite of being alive is to be dead. And to stay alive, there are certain vital substances or materials. They don't really think of these in chemical terms, like food and air. You have to get in food and air from the outside to maintain life. That's what the mouth and the nose are for. There are the first containers or receptacles inside the body. The lungs are the first receptacle for air. The stomach is the first receptacle for food. And then what blood does is take the food and air to all parts of the body, and explanation stops there. Right? Now, that's actually quite a lot of theoretical knowledge. And what death is the breakdown of that bodily machine. Okay, so when that goes wrong, if you don't have enough food, or if this mechanism breaks in some sense, then you die. Okay, that's the biology. That the content of the notion of living thing for a 6-year-old is essentially given by that set of interrelated concepts. Okay, and the claim is that 4-year-olds or old 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds ain't got any of that. Right? They don't understand the body as a machine. They don't have the notion of alive at all. And the evidence, and what they have instead, is an undifferentiated concept. And this notion of undifferentiation, lack of differentiation, is the essence of these kinds of conceptual changes. So they have a notion of alive. They have the word alive. They've heard it. But the concept that underlies it is an undifferentiated concept that has something to do with the story I just told you. But it also means exists, active, agent. Okay? So they have a concept which has all of these features in it that are undifferentiated. That is, they don't realize that these are distinct, that these elements play distinct conceptual roles. Okay? Now, this is the notion of differentiation in these kinds of conceptual changes that involve incommensurability. Right. Differentiation is very common in conceptual development. So children may have a concept of dog and not realize that there are poodles and labradors and collies. They haven't differentiated dog into subcategories of dogs. That kind of differentiation occurs commonly. We learn that there are subtypes of things we have. But that doesn't implicate this kind of conceptual change, because once you've made that distinction, the old concept of dog still functions exactly the same way in a conceptual system as it did before. You just realize there are different kinds of dogs. If you have this as an undifferentiated concept, once you've created that vital biology, this doesn't stay around as a superordinate in a new conceptual system. This is incoherent in terms of the new conceptual system. That's what makes this really qualitatively different. Now, what's the evidence that the child has this sort of undifferentiated concept of a living thing? Well, there's tons of evidence. My favorite evidence is Piagetian clinical interview evidence. I mean, I think that this is where one of the places where Piaget was an absolute genius was in characterizing the content of children's concepts with these clinical interviews. So, but you get these clinical interviews yourself just talking to a 3-year-old. 3-year-olds are very, very interested in this domain of concepts. So my 3-year-old asked me the following question. I don't know if this was in the chapter that you read. That's funny. Statues are not alive, but you can still see them. And I said, what? And she said, well, Grandpa's dead, and that's sad because you can't see him anymore. Okay. Look at this, right? Exists and alive in the sense of not dead. And I said, well, oh, you've just failed to distinguish dead from inanimate. I didn't actually say that. I said, no, I see. I said, you know, some things like animals and plants, first they're alive and then they die, and then that's sad because we can't see them anymore. But other things like tables and chairs, they're never alive. So they can't die. They're just not alive. Okay, now if somebody has this concept, how in the hell is she going to understand what I just said? And of course, she didn't. What she said was, yeah, isn't that funny? Tables and chairs are not alive, but you can still see them. So I just expanded the... Now, look, statues are particularly interesting. She started with statues because there's another aspect of here, too. Real, in the sense of as opposed to representation. So statues are not real. They're not agents. They're not active. So in those senses, they aren't alive, but they do exist, right? But dead people don't exist anymore, right? So basically, she has some version of these concepts, but she's united them in this concept of alive. What dead is just the opposite of live. It's not the end of a life cycle. Now, to make death the end of a life cycle, you have to create this vitalist biology where you have the bodily machine, the breakdown of which can be the end of that life cycle. So the creation of that notion of the bodily machine is part of the process of differentiating out this alive from this undifferentiated concept. And this is going to take her 3 years, right? So she's, you know, she certainly had it by the time she's five or six, very firmly. That's partly because she quickly learned that anytime she raised any question in this domain to me, I would be extremely interested. So she was coming to me with biological conundrums all the time. She's grown up to be a philosopher, so she also had this very analytic mind. So another example was we were walking in the woods, and she said, "How do dead people go to the bathroom?" Okay. And I said, "What?" I mean, my first reaction was always be taken quite off. And she said, "Well, maybe they have bathrooms under the ground." I didn't help in this one. I said, no, they don't need bathrooms under the ground. You know, when you die, you just lie there. You don't do it." So I'm actually, I'm not going to really tell her, right? And you don't eat or drink. You don't need bathrooms. So she said, "Yeah, but they ate or drank before they died." So, you know, this is the philosopher there. Okay. Now this is extremely interesting because what you're seeing here is this is a three-year-old. Okay. The idea that three-year-olds don't have the logical capacities of adults is nuts. Right? She's got the logical capacities fine. She just doesn't have the concepts yet to, you know, and she's even noticing inherent contradictions in her concepts. But she doesn't have the wherewithal yet to resolve those contradictions. So she's raising those problems for me to help her, you know, make sense of. But she can't understand what I tell her to try to make sense of them.
Is there a possibility that in the Vygotskian sense you're supporting her zone of proximal development?
Sure. Sure, absolutely. That's, you know, those ideas are not at all incompatible with this. I mean, the point is, when you look at what the kind of bootstrapping mechanisms are that underlie conceptual change, what you need is the proper analysis of what this is and this, and an analysis of what the bootstrapping processes are, and then what you want to do is to give them, you know, an analysis just in terms of where they are now, what the next step would be. Right. So, of course, this is absolutely consistent with that, but it's telling you what kind of analysis of the conceptual content you need to manage to do that. Right. Yeah, the trouble with extensive experience is, again, how do they make sense of that experience, right? So, yes, of course you have to. But what I would say is you also want an analysis of what this conceptual system is, so that you know what problem you're trying to get over. Right? So, what I tried to do in this chapter was to give you a sense of what the concepts were of the preschool child who doesn't yet have a vitalist biology and make sense of phenomena like childhood animism, the fact that they tell you that buttons are alive because they hold your pants up. Okay. Now, look, when a child says that, you can think of it as, well, the child just has a very weird belief about buttons. Or you could think the child means something different about by alive than I do. And I'm saying you better think about it that latter way. And so you really need to know that if you happen to be trying to design a curricular intervention about intuitive biology for preschool children. Right? So, but that's not inconsistent with the Vygotskian zone of possible development level kind of analysis. Mm-hmm.
During the transition from CS1 to CS2, would there be times where you would be vacillating back and forth between the two? And if that's true, then is that inconsistent with the idea of incommensurability? Because you don't just get the scale goes there, and then all of a sudden...
The notion of incommensurability doesn't require a single gestalt shift. In historical cases in the history of science, you know, often the period of transition was 150 years, right? And, you know, and in children, it's not a single gestalt shift either, right? So it's not that you can't flip back and forth because CS2 is a whole great big structure. But what you can have done is build partial understandings in partial domains, which aren't, whereas in partial, in a bit of the relevant theory. And you haven't yet worked out one in another part. That's where you're going to lead to these kinds of inconsistencies. So you could certainly, and you do see lots of inconsistency in the middle of this kind of transition. But you certainly don't see. Once you've gotten this, the idea of buttons being alive because they hold your pants up is not something that you entertain anymore. In fact, if you show a child a video of themselves doing one of these interviews 2 years later, they're extremely embarrassed and think that they have no access to those intuitions anymore. So it really is a conceptual change. But it doesn't happen at a moment. Yeah.
Does that kind of conceptual change always happen spontaneously when there is enough contradictory tension among the data?
As I say in the chapter, the issue of contradiction is motivating but doesn't give you the answer.
Yeah.
As you can see by these examples, I mean, I'll just give you another example. I mean, I think my daughter examples are what helped me think about this most. But so if you have children or if you're teachers, you see these things all the time. So my daughter came home, different domain. She said, this is a 7-year-old. Well, they told me in school today that the earth is round like an orange, but I don't believe it for a second. And I said, well, why not? She said, well, if the earth is round like an orange, then there are some people who are upside down, the ones on the bottom. And I thought about that. And I thought, well, maybe the people in China are upside down. But then I thought, if the people were in China were upside down, surely somebody would have mentioned that. So, and this is verbatim. I mean, as I say, this kid is a philosopher now. Then she said, well, so then I thought, she knows that the earth, you know, turns in the middle of the night. And she said, well, maybe we're all upside down in the middle of the night. But then I noticed sometimes I have to get up in the middle of the night or I'm sick and we're not upside down. So I don't believe this for a second. So I said, well, you know, there's really two different frames of reference here, right? Sure, with respect to the earth, you know, these people are upside down. I mean, with respect to, if we were looking at the earth from some vantage point, those people are upside down. But from the point of view of the center of the earth itself, all of these are right side up. Okay. She could not understand this resolution to the problem, right? And she kept repeating her arguments. She thought I wasn't understanding her argument. I said, look, these are brilliant arguments. These are all in the Greek literature. You know, I do. And I understand it. And the problem is this notion of a geometrical frame of reference. She was in tears. You know, she thought I wasn't understanding her. She was not able to understand. We agreed that she should just hold on to these questions and that I promised her that sometime in the future she would understand how to resolve this problem. But the point is, you can understand the contradiction, but the question from a conceptual change point of view is, where do you get the new concepts to resolve the contradiction? being disequilibrium is not the answer. Right? Showing them the contradiction isn't the answer. You have to somehow give them the new set of concepts. And the question is, how do you do that?
Can they arrive at the new set of concepts on their own, or do they have to be presented?
Well, I mean, I think that in the cases of these conceptual changes, the new theories are cultural constructions, right? So this is, so in fact, they're not going to do them. I mean, these new theories, I mean, a vitalist biology is a pretty universal cultural construction, actually. It's a cross-cultural, near universal. But it has very different forms in different cultures. And so if the child doesn't come in contact with the language and the artifacts that embody this new system, they're not going to, they may need something to make sense of.
Field of knowledge, and a child lives in a society that has a very naive understanding.
This is a case. Yeah, this is these are cases where the child is scientist metaphor doesn't mean the child has a little theory and is encountering data in the world and changing their theory as a lone scientist. That's a very lousy metaphor for scientist as a scientist also. But science is a cultural construction. Right, and these are cultural constructions. So, and the child is not going to make these conceptual changes unless they come in contact. And so, it can be in a school setting, but in fact, this vitalist biology isn't taught in school. This is one that there's plenty of evidence in the experience. I mean, these concepts of death, growth, identity through the life, you know, the life cycle, birth. These are, you know, where people come from. I mean, these are questions that arise to children. But the answers that they're given are the intuitive biology that the culture has constructed.
Is the difference between the scientific paradigm shift, that where new data or new concepts are not available versus children?
Yeah. Good question. So the question is, what's the relation between the mechanisms by which children make these conceptual changes and the mechanisms by which science made them the first time, right? The answer is, I believe, that they're clearly, it's clearly different to be making the conceptual change by a process of learning, bootstrapping up a conceptual system that the people around you already know, and having to do it the first time. But the child as scientist metaphor requires the following to be true: that there's a set of questions, such as what kind of descriptive differences are there between CS1 and CS2? What does it mean to have a different concept of alive or a different concept of burning, right? When I say that a 7-year-old has not differentiated weight from density, do I mean the same thing as historians of science would say when they say Galileo had not distinguished differentiated heat from temperature? So at a analytic level, do what we mean by lack of differentiation, is it the same in the two cases? So there's a set of questions that are questions about the description of the relation between the conceptual system at time one and time two that get the same answer in the two cases. And the mechanisms by which you create such a change, there are common mechanisms. Now, in addition, scientists are metaconceptually aware, right? And so there are certainly disanalogies, but there are a set of questions. In fact, the bootstrapping mechanisms that we use in science education are based on diary studies of scientists doing it, right? The claim is that there are enough similarities in spite of the obvious differences to make this a productive analysis. It's not just a metaphor. There's an identity of part of the process. It's the claim. Yeah.
it gets to that question of this transition, and you spoke to it earlier, it sounds like my sort of interpretation of this is that there's a sort of a logical framework that the child is using that would potentially be said that is innate. I don't know exactly where that fits in, but that's the mechanism that really drives going from the one conceptual system to the next, because in a sense you could say first conceptual system is sort of an imprecise conceptual system. It's sort of a with the usage of different definitions, there's a working sort of maybe model, and obviously it's maybe not consciously developed,
but
there's some model, and through the process of consciously sorting out what you're implicit, what you're, the language is tricky here, but what your, say, model predictions would say, you, through the use of logic, you have the ability, the capacity then to...
What I would say, and it's time to stop, it's 2 o'clock, is that all of that is right. I mean, it's the use of logic that is getting you to notice that a prediction fails or that there's an inherent contradiction. I mean, all of these things that my daughter was raising had to do with contradictions, right? That's logic. But the use of logic alone doesn't tell you where the new theory came from. So if you had the phlogiston theory of burning, logic alone is not going to give you the concept of oxygen, right? So we still have a problem, right? And we don't have time, but the part of where I talk about bootstrapping mechanisms are my answer to that question. So not taking away what you said, I absolutely do believe that that those logical capacities are absolutely essential, but they still haven't completely taken on the problem of where the new concepts come from. And what I try to do in that chapter is sketch what I call bootstrapping mechanisms. So, anyway.